want. Like, you know, it's but they can take time off in the summer, but we're just making sure we always have people on hand.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Folks, we're talking about Midsummer, the famous Swedish Midsummer. And how do you actually run a business when essentially most of your staff might actually be on a four-week holiday? You know, a fascinating thing to try and experiment with. And we'll dive back into that because I do want to, because I think this is one of those very interesting challenges as to how you actually stay true to the culture of the country that you're in and, you know, doing right by the employees that are there, but also at the same time, as you say, how do you do international coverage in this situation? So that's something we'll certainly work that out as we go. And but yes, Maciej, absolutely right. We all want to experience Midsummer. I think broadly speaking, anybody who criticizes Swedish Midsummer is just secretly jealous. Like we all want to do it. All right, listen, we're on Founders Focus, folks, and we're still waiting for Victor. If I can see him, I'm going to bring him on straight away. Oh, there he is. Let's pop him on screen now. Folks, I just want to say this has turned into absolutely the favorite thing for me to do every week because it is very, very interesting for me to learn from people that are involved in recruitment technology businesses that are there to really change the way in which we live and work today. And I hope you'll share with me sort of this enthusiasm and also the opportunity to learn from these entrepreneurial characters and what they can tell us about, you know, how it is to think about business, how it is to think about leadership and what have you. So let's sort of welcome our guests today. It is Adrian McDonald, CEO of Adway, and it is Victor Nord, founder of Adway. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thank you very much.
Really happy to be here, Hung.
Happy to be here.
Great to see you. First thing I need to do is compliment Victor's hair. It is as good as it looks in video. I need to find a hairdresser. I really do because this is no longer acceptable, you know. Okay, let's get on with the show, folks. I mean, we always start with the same question. You two are super busy. I'm very conscious of the fact that, you know what, whenever I do a Founders Focus, I'm probably like depleting the resources of a company that can't afford to have two people out for an hour. So what have you two got canceled today in order to come into the show? What did you have to push back an hour in order to appear and join us today?
I can start. So I had a meeting with our COO that I had to squeeze into 15 minutes. Then I basically had to run from where I had the meeting to the office. So I'm a bit sweaty. So I physically run together with the dog in order to make it the time in here.
I feel sorry for your COO that had to have a truncated meeting, and I feel sorry for your heart rate as well, Victor. I do thank you for coming onto the show. How about you, Adrian? What did you have to push back in order to appear here today?
Lunch. Like, to be honest with you, I had planned to go and get some food, and then I've been on calls ever since, and so I actually skipped it. So I'm going to have a late lunch.
All right.
I'm hoping I'm going to be fully functional on this.
Well, mate, let's start right there. Because actually, like, physical health and refueling is something I think entrepreneurs do a really bad job of because of exactly this. It's always deprioritized. Let's grab it, eat at my desk. You know, let's do all, you know, like, literally not thinking about food is an important thing. We know that's not correct, right? We know we need to actually refuel properly with healthy ingredients and actually take time to eat. How do you kind of balance the responsibilities, the pressures, all of this other stuff that seems to be super urgent with your own kind of need to maintain yourself as an asset for the business? Because let's face it, you are an asset for the business. You need to think of yourself this way. How do you balance those two those two things? Adrian, let's start with you, seeing you skipped lunch. How do you balance this?
Yeah, it's quite easy, actually, for me. I mean, there are always so many challenges and things that you need to that are going to pop up. There's always fires to fight. There is always challenges internally in the business, maybe with customers, with people, whatever it might be. My realization is you can't be everywhere. Like, you just can't solve it. So you have to pick and choose wisely. I think that's the main thing. And my general rule of thumb is I'm happy to let fires burn and just really try to stay focused on the things that matter most. And that can change invariably from week to week or day to day. So clearly it's about, you know, making sure things that matter most is that we have fantastic product that our customers love. So that's going, you know, really important that we're scaling in the markets where we want to go and that our people are taken care of. And then outside of that, if there's sort of structural issues or if there's administrative issues, I'm happy to just let them slide. You can't balance it all. That's the reality. So you have to pick the fights.
Folks, that's a really important lesson for everybody, because I think a lot of leaders, a lot of entrepreneurs beat themselves up because they haven't solved every problem. You know, that to-do list, they haven't done it and they feel mm-hmm. terrible. Guess what? The to-do list is infinite. There's no end to it. And we have to somehow get comfortable with that sense of incompleteness because it's almost like, you can't perfectly do it. You can do it to a certain point, and then you've got to move on to the next task. How about you, Victor? What's your strategy to keep you physically, mentally in shape?
Yeah, so first of all, I read a lot, and I make time to actually read and listen to a lot of podcasts. Yours, one of them, of course. But there's another guy called Jim Quick. He has a podcast called Quick Brain or something like that. And he always talks about the routines of physical health in order to have a quick brain. So trying to build up routines around that one. So when you wake up in the morning, I have certain routines, you go and drink some water, and make sure I have enough time with my daughter as well. And I'm also making sure I'm not logging into my phone, watching the email or Teams or Slack channels or anything like that until I actually go into work modus. So I make some space for myself, first of all, and trying to build this new routines and habits. It's not always that easy, but I try to follow it. And then my second trick is that I don't have any notifications at all. You can't even call me. I will not see it. Adrian knows this one. So with the exception of my family and a few people on emergencies, of course, but otherwise, I don't let any technicalities make up my attention. So when I'm in a meeting or when I do something, I don't get any notifications at all. So now I'm at the computer, I don't see any emails and then get any pings on LinkedIn. I don't see anything at all. So that's my other trick to keep fresh and then try to work with the to-do list that I prioritize every morning and work up, down. And they usually eat that big frog first, the old school management trick, and then used to walk by to-dos, basically.
Loads of great input there. Let's just go with the notification. I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, you know it when you're on a Zoom call with somebody and their Slack or WhatsApp is pinging away. You know they're not engaged in this conversation, right? Yeah, like, no way. And it is actually... You know, it's almost like there's times when I felt, you know what, maybe it's better we reset until we're focusing on this because you're not there. I can see that your eyes are on this and there's various things. You're allowing these intrusions to occur. And in fact, I think a great deal of what busy work is stuff coming at you. Like I had a revelation maybe only like very recently, a year ago, when I realized my inbox was literally people telling me what to do. You know what I mean? It was like none of the stuff in my inbox is what I want to do. It's all people making demands on me or all people asking me something. And I'm saying, if I spend time in my inbox, I'm doing their work. I'm not doing the stuff I need to do. So one of the rules I've set is I don't actually check inbox until 10 o'clock in the morning because I need those 2 hours in the morning to do whatever I need to do. Then I'm happy to interact and sort of engage with people and stuff like this because it doesn't work. I think one of those lessons I think leaders particularly need to learn fairly early on because everyone's going to ask you for stuff, right? Everyone's going to come in and say, what do you think, Victor? What do you think, Adrian? You do need to have a system to get those decisions made even, and you can't be the person absorbing it. How do you kind of delegate in a way that makes that sort of lower level just below you empowered but not abandoned, if that makes any sense? So how do you make sure that they feel, yes, I can do this, but they're not like, no, oh, I can't go to Victor, there's no support, and I can't go to Adrian, no support. How do you kind of do that?
Yeah, it's tricky. Depends what types of decisions being made. I think if you're looking at things such as just like execution, or if you're looking at like budget and costs and like and how teams need to operate day to day, I don't want to get involved in that stuff. You know, obviously I want to know, I want them to know that they have a budget that they can work with. They have the mandate to, I mean, that they have a plan in place, which we look at with some clear milestones of goals and what have you. How they get there, I don't care as much about, because I think people will be creative and we hire great people because they have better ideas than us. So I think if as long as people have very clear direction where they need to go, what they need to achieve, then I think it's important to just empower them to get there as in the way that they see best fit. That's why we hire people. So trying to delegate like the execution plan and giving the teams the accountability for those goals is really important. Then you free up a lot of time for sure. So that's important. And there was interesting, since you spoke about decisions and timing, there was a great post. We were talking about this yesterday, Victor, around being present versus having balance. And the CEO of HubSpot, Yamini Rangan, she did post on this on LinkedIn the other day. She said like she invests more time in just being present at that moment in time. So you have to delegate as much as you can. You have to hire the great people who can pick up the slack and can take charge and lead. Really, it's like I see my job as really just trying to make sure, conduct and make sure that the teams are fully functional, they're interacting well, people are, that their well-being is high, so that I don't have to take as many decisions.
And I agree with Adrian on that one, like trying to make the team feel powerful enough to make decisions really fast and just go with it. Doesn't need to be the right decision as long as they execute and do something. That's our... Yeah. And then if we did something wrong, then we just cheer it up and we try to learn something from it and then go ahead and do something new. And I hope that our organization, when they come to me with something, I'm just going to tell them, like, just go and execute. I believe in you. But my problem as an entrepreneur is that I will probably give them 10 more ideas. Yeah, you can do this and this and this as well on top of your actual to-do. So my challenge is that when they come with maybe small tasks that are easy to execute on, I will just go on the whiteboard and I will spend 5 minutes and then I will map out 10 more possibilities. Yeah, that's the challenge of being an entrepreneur, I guess.
That's really good. It's great self-awareness, Victor, because your mind is like sparked by problems, isn't it? When you have the entrepreneur mindset, you're excited about the possibilities and then straight away you're externalizing them. Where you know the person who just want a decision, it's like I don't know what to do. Give me a left or right on this, you know, something like this. Sure. Very interesting balance. In terms of this development, cultivation of self-awareness, I mean, do you think this is important in leadership, or do you think it's possible to just be who you are and then have, you know, just so long as you hire the people that recognize this is your style? You know, this is about the 30th conversation I've had so far with business leaders that do recruiting technology. I can tell you, like, everyone is so different, personality-wise, so different. And I'm just thinking, you know what? Self-awareness is great. It's important. But is it more important just to align your team with the kind of leadership style that you have? Do you know what I mean? It's almost like the certain senior leaders, senior managers that are going to be super appropriate for Adway because you two are there, but they would not be suitable for another business because there's a different style of leadership in that company.
100%. I can give you a little insight on our history, and then I will give the rest of the words to Adrian. But we decided when we started the company really early on to bring in Sophia, who is our head of people, into the company. We were only 6 employees at that time. And we took the bet of bringing in Sophia and making sure we cemented the culture we had because we really liked it. And then we had the culture fit kind of requirement assessments in every recruitment profile. We've been talking a lot about the culture, trying to define the culture a couple of times together with all the employees. So we spent enormous amount of time to protect it and develop it from the early on.
Your question around self-awareness, I think it's you absolutely need to have it, I think, to be a good leader, especially today. I mean, the demands of leaders today and the way the world is, like, obviously it's it's changing. And I don't think that any of us are really born with, like, I mean, you're born with some qualities, but I think to be a good leader is like, it's an art form. You need to keep mastering it, working at it, and being conscious of it every day. At least from my perspective, that's been my journey and my experience. So it's always good to have some degree of self-awareness, of course. I mean, because I think at the end of the day, people join, as you just pointed out, Victor, people join companies usually a lot because of the people as well. And they're bought into the vision because of whoever delivers it to them. And they will leave for those same reasons as well. I think they'll leave people. So if you're not aware of how you're communicating, you're not aware of how you're inspiring or having a detrimental impact on people, then I think you've got big problems.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think below a certain brand of company that are, you know, these mega brands that may be so overwhelming that people are attracted to them irrespective of who's around them, right? Most companies are not that way. You know, we're just like one tier below. And those companies, it's the peer-to-peer relationships that are important and your immediate boss. Who's in your immediate universe, they're the ones that make the decisive difference for your choices in whether you join or not. Victor, you talked to us about the early beginnings. Let's go there. What is the origin story of Adway? Because your career is like kind of really kind of crazy and unusual in many respects, because you went straight in, you're a young dude, getting into entrepreneurship at such a young age, and that's basically been your path. So can you tell us when did Adway became a thing and you knew it was this is what we're gonna do?
Yeah, sure. So I wonder how long I should back in time. So I back it since I've been born and raised in an entrepreneurial family. So it's always been in my blood to the natural cause of being an entrepreneur. My sister's an entrepreneur. I'm an entrepreneur. My father's always been, and my mother's always supporting that one as well. So I went in and started working as a sales individual for a recruitment company. That's how I went into recruitment industry from the first beginning. And then I sold a lot of recruitments within the staffing industry, but I couldn't deliver as many people as I sold. So then I started trying to find people myself. And this was my early 20s when I was in Norway and I sold Swedish professionals to go into and work in Norway. So then I started out, I could recruit them from Sweden myself. So I just picked up my phone and I used to call my friends and family and I used to recruit them to Norway. So this was my path into recruitment industry from a sales perspective. I found a need and I found the staff and then I matched them together. And eventually I thought, maybe now I'm doing almost 360 of the business, because I always did the admin and invoices. So for me to pivot into starting a company was very easy for me, because I basically did the same, right? So I went back to Sweden, in Gothenburg, where I am now, and I started my first company as a recruitment company. And that, fast forward a bit, we ended up being a supplier to the market instead, to the recruiting and staffing industry. Instead of having them as competitors, we built a CV databases, job ads, like a CV library or Monster, etc., but a niche between Sweden and Norway. So that was my path, doing a SaaS business without knowing what a SaaS business really was, or entrepreneur. The word entrepreneur wasn't so popular back then as well. So then I did that for a couple of years, ended up with 6,000 clients in Norway, recruiting and staffing clients, and a huge amount of community with the Swedish professionals.
Dominating. I mean, you must be the dominant place in Norway, right? That was that number. You got to be.
And it was in the timing when Norway was booming because of oil and gas industry as well. So I took the engineers from Sweden and we just put them out in the oil and gas and subsea engineering path. So I did that one, sold the business eventually to a staffing recruiting firm. Went, did some HR consultancy for some big brands, how they should procure tech and how they should think about getting as many talents as possible into their ATS system. Did that one, thought I wanted to create a new company, which then was a slim version of building career pages. You can say like Phenom people in combination with an easy to use ATS system. That was my idea. So then I started that company. After 2 years, we had 200 clients in Sweden, got an offer on the table, sold that one again because the competition heated up, went back to did some more HR consultancy. And here's where I tie it together with the original story of Adway then, because when I did this HR consultancy, I've always been super interested about data, right? So I looked at all the data points and I saw that a lot of hires were coming from job boards, of course, and organic search, etc. But social media started to spark in the data points without the companies having any strategy and tactic for social media in the recruiting HR. So then I thought, aha. Then I used to find a software that could connect a test system to social media and problem solve. So I tried to research and tried to procure that one for a couple of companies, couldn't find it. Did find it for e-commerce and the travel industry, but couldn't find it specifically for the HR industry. And here's where I took this embryo of an idea, and I called my friend, who's also an entrepreneur, who's an automation expert, doing like really big scale automation tech before. And I just brought it up with him on a whiteboard session. And I've always wanted to do something with him, entrepreneurial wise. And yeah, the moon was in the right state of mind, and we just said, ah, let's do it. And that was the embryo and start of Adway. And then since then, it's been a bit more complicated than we thought from the beginning, just to connect it and make it high performing. But that was the storyline.
That is the story. And by the way, for folks who don't know what Adway is, how would you two describe it? Can you give us like a very high level? Like, I don't know anything about Adway. I've encountered it. Oh, what is this? How do you describe?
Yeah. Do you want to go, Adrian?
No, go for it. Go for it. It's okay.
Yeah, so then I will describe it as an automated social media publisher for job ads. So we take all the job ads that you have on your career page, and we make sure we can publish them by paid ads on social media. That's the simplest of versions. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then on top of that one, we have the algorithm and AI that is working with the personas and the target audiences to make sure we do the programmatic bidding in the right way. But at simplest, you could say we take all the vacancies and we push them on social media and getting more hires in the funnel.
Hey, Victor, you're talking to a recruiter audience, man. You've got to make it simple. And yeah, I totally get it. Basically, I already have these jobs published on a career page. I need to boost the distribution. I need to get more candidates. I use Adway, and what you guys do is basically pump them into the right social media channels, into the right demographics in those social media channels, and I get better candidates. That's basically it.
Perfect. Now you can join the sales team.
Yeah, man. I should be writing, you know, marketing copy for people. No, I don't. You've already got a better marketing team than I can shake a fist at. That's really
good thing you just recorded.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? Use that snippet. I mean, go. Because sometimes one of the problems with marketing generally is to condense. There was a really interesting theory. I don't know whether you know the Reddit subreddit called Explain It Like I'm Five. It's one of the funniest and I think most important subreddits out there, because it tries to condense overly complicated conversations in like as if you're talking to a five-year-old. And it's actually really challenging when you're talking politics or when you're talking stuff that's difficult. But when it comes to marketing services and products, you have to do that, because people have almost like a five-year-old like attention span, right? Yeah. They're not going to be analyzing.
An old Einstein quote, right? If you can't explain it to a child, you don't know it good enough.
You don't know it exactly. The best.
Maybe it's not Einstein, but some kind of quote.
Let's attribute it to some genius sort of back in those days. No, that's great. This is super interesting in terms of what the product is. Tell us about sort of how you then market it. Because it seems to me like, okay, here's interesting, because what you're doing is providing essentially a recruiting marketing solution. How does that apply to you then marketing your solution? It's like the meta marketing of Adway. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because it's still a trend that is rising really, really fast. And in the simplest of ways, a lot of big organizations already claim that they have all the vacancies on social media. So then they could check off the box and they don't need to buy from us, right? But when you try to make it a bit more more concrete and you have an organization and you publish 10,000 jobs or 100,000 jobs a year and you want to push them into five social media channels with different formats, then you need to create 500,000 job ads on social media. And then for every single job ad, you also need to then put some media spend behind it and do the exact hyper-targeting approach you want to do in order to get the applicants. Here's where the complexity comes in when you scale it up. So almost every single recruiter could push out one job ad or 10 job ads on social media. You can buy it on LinkedIn yourself with your credit card, and you can work with self-service approaches if you want to buy it on Facebook and Instagram, etc. But when you scale it up, it becomes super complex. So if you're a big global organization and you want to build a strategy, maybe you want to bid differently in different countries. You want to have copywriting in other languages, and you want to use different social media channels in different markets, etc., etc. It very quickly becomes super complex, and then you need a system and a provider in order to help you do that one. So that's the biggest pain we saw on the market, and that's, I would say, is the biggest trend on the market as well. I really like job boards, right? I'm coming from a job boards background, but the job boards are struggling a bit on the traffic right now with all the passive candidates on the markets. So if you don't have a strategy and tactic in order to go after the passive candidates, you're not going to win the war of talent at all. And it's not not enough to just publish your ad on your LinkedIn newsfeed or publish it on your own Facebook feed organically. That will not give you the results you need. You need to do the programmatic paying behind it.
Yeah, and you absolutely need to distribute it in places where people pay attention. And guess what? Normal people don't look at LinkedIn. Recruiters stare at it every day. But you know what? I think the average sort of usage is about once a month, I think, in terms of signing in, because basically normal human beings, civilians, they're getting on with their day. It's only like salespeople and recruiters that are watching this.
Yeah.
And I know there's people watching my LinkedIn right now. Guarantee you, you're a recruiter. It's okay. It's fine to be a recruiter, but let's understand that we're also in kind of this mega bubble where we're using this tool every day. Most people aren't looking at it. Adrian, let's go to you. You dropped into this company as the CEO of the business. How did that happen? Why did it happen? What's the story behind you becoming, the CEO of this business?
Well, it's a funny story. Victor has his spin on it, and I have mine. But I
I want to hear it.
Okay, the story was, Victor, you can tell the story about the event. I feel like I'm gushing. I was speaking at a scale-up event down in Gothenburg. I was invited to come and give a speech and. And effectively, you had a lot of all these like rock star entrepreneurs of Sweden who become billionaires who were on stage, and then there was this Aussie guy with called Adrian McDonough who got up. And so I think Victor had come to this event for all these rock stars, but it was through when I started speaking, he sort of his ears pricked up. He's like, I've got to meet that guy. So we got talking at the event. Basically, I was there and I had a company and I was advising a lot of tech founders in the Nordics primarily, so like over 100 of them. So I was sharing lessons learned of scaling companies and what have you. So I was an advisor, so it was more of a consultancy business. Victor came running up. He's like, hey, I'll buy whatever you've got. Like, let's just do the deal now. And so I was advising Victor and Richard for about 12 months. And I think it was after about 3 or 4 months, this is sort of very early 2020, so we met late 2019. They said, hey, would you consider coming on board? And this was pre-pandemic, and I had a company, other investments with some friends. I'm like, that's not going to fly. And then so they kept persisting for about 9 months, and then finally it made sense. So the stars aligned. But it was perfect because, we got time to work together, get to know each other, establish trust, a common way of working. And the reality was that he loves being out in the market. He loves selling. I've never met a sales guy as passionate as him. Richard loves products and tech. And so they just, I guess it's fair to say you guys reached the realization where you're like, you want to do what you're passionate about. Why take on responsibilities for things that you don't feel comfortable with? Let's get someone who's happy to do that. And so that's how we how we came together.
Yeah, that's really exciting version of the story. I'm reminded of that very famous Kurosawa movie, Rashomon, where, you know, you have like four different, completely different stories on the same event. So yeah. I'm going to go to you, Victor, on this. But I think it is fascinating for a founder to recognize that you don't want to be a CEO. Most founders think, oh, yeah, sure, I'm going to be the CEO. Why are you not the CEO? How do you know this is not your role, Victor?
Yeah, good good question. Now is the time I'm going to challenge Adrian and take the CEO role. This is not you're kidding.
I'd love to see that. So no.
I would be terrible doing that job. No, so when me and Richard, who's the other co-founder, founded the company, we had this discussion. Who's going to be the CEO? What's your role going to be? Because Richard is a brilliant tech mind, right? But he's also a brilliant entrepreneur and could absolutely take the CEO role of the company. And I could also take the CEO role of the company. I've done it before many times. But when we started the company, we said, this time we really want to work with our passion. So we don't want to have a CEO until the right timing in the company. So we actually founded the company without having a CEO. We brought up the company. I can't really remember how many employees were we when you came in, Adrian?
Under 25, somewhere 23, 22, 23, something like that.
Yeah. So at that level, we didn't have a CEO. And that's very unusual.
So you operated up until 25 without a title of a CEO in the business.
Yeah. But you could also then claim that the interim CEO, which was the COO, still the COO, another Victor in the company, took that role a bit. Yep. To like so you could say he was a kind of a hybrid role, but he didn't either want to have the CEO role. So we have all an agreement in between that at a certain point of time, we need to have the CEO. And that was also one of the conclusions Adrian helped us to draw when we used him as a consultant. Like, now you're growing so fast and you're getting so many customers into the funnel. You have huge amount of problems everywhere. The employees needs clarity and you need to have the vision and you need to bring everyone together. And then we say, yeah, okay, so now it's probably the timing we need to put in a CEO. And then was naturally folded together with Adrian. Adrian was the perfect fit. And the we actually did some kind of undercover mission together with Adrian as well, because you wanted to test the organization and be in the organization as well. So Adrian was in with all the conferences, with all the people, talking with all the people, without them knowing that we all thought Adrian was the perfect CEO, including then Adrian as well. So many people were surprised when we announced it, but everyone was super happy. So it was a very strange recruitment process, you could say, but a very good one.
Yeah, fascinating study. And I am fascinated about the concept of, you know, being able to grow a business to a certain degree, to a significant degree. You know, when you're having 20 odd employees or so, that's actually a reasonable business right there. But then there's a moment where you need to change it and you need to have that figure into position. In which case, guys, what makes a good CEO? Do you have some like basic criteria where you say, you know, if you boil every CEO, yes, we know they're all different, we all know their different personalities, etc., but all of them have these three things. Can you give us what those things might be if you agree with that characterization?
Yeah, do you want to start, Adrian?
I can just give my perspective of the things that I try to work on, rather than saying, I mean, it's really hard to know like what makes sense. What I'm constantly always observing other CEOs and other leaders, trying to learn from them and figure out what are they doing well. What's really clear for sure is that you need to be a very good listener. You have to listen. You have to have the ability to listen at like high and low, from like grassroots in the company, like someone's got a problem with their girlfriend or wife, whatever it might be, you know, or they're sick, or, you know, to the big challenges structurally in the company. So since you have to make decisions, so you have to be able to listen, and you're going to hear varying different opinions and different thoughts. So for me, that seems fairly obvious. And if you're not listening, you better have a pretty good crystal ball in front of you to see the future. So that for me is definitely the first thing. The second thing is making sure that through that, then you get you're optimizing the organization in the best way. And that could be like people are developing. It could be that you're bringing in the best people, that teams are interacting, that you have the right capabilities and you have the right construct. I think that is really critical. And that was the point I made before around sort of being the conductor. You're not the musician. You're steering everyone to create this great symphony. So that's to me is quite important. And then probably last but not least, you have to have a vision for the future. You have to see, you have to be able to sort of communicate and share with the company, like, where are we going? And I don't mean that just like once a year. Like you also need to be communicating and sharing with people, like, on, you know, as regularly as possible. So I think if you're not doing that, and listen, I'm not saying I do that perfectly, but I think those are the things I generally try to work on. And there may be other things I'm happy to sort of take advice and inspiration from others. But for me, it's like those three things are the most important.
Thank you, Adrian. Go ahead.
I can give my take on it. So I wrote it down as you were speaking. And before you said it, I wrote down some of the same stuff in here. But I think what's important here is that you have different CEOs for different stages in the company. And the different kind of companies as well. We're still considerably a small company, even though we're close to 100 employees. We're still a small company, but with a super intense growth rate right now. So today I said hello to three people I didn't know almost existed in the company just this morning in the office. So we're growing so fast, and at that speed, what we needed in the company. And what we saw was that we need someone with experience with that kind of hyper growth, because otherwise the company is just going to be splitted too much, and we're going to lose focus on the core deliveries to the customers. So with Adrian, you didn't mention your background, but with Adrian's background, it makes total sense to have someone that has been into this kind of hyper growth before within the industry. And already knows which pitfalls to make and not to make. So that one is one of the things that's super important. The listening part, I've never came across anyone as good listener as Adrian. So he's the superstar on that one, drawing conclusions of what everyone else is saying, asking really tough questions in a nice way. Is always based from where he listens in. So that's super nice. And then, of course, we want someone to make bold bets right now, because we have funding in the company, and we are growing so fast, and we want to make sure we can make a global impact. We need to make bold bets almost every week in different directions. So you can't be a farmer kind of individual. You need to be a hunter kind of individual, even in the CEO position at this stage, because you need to make the bets product-wise and delivery-wise, customer success-wise, market-wise, sales-wise, everywhere. It was a long answer. Sorry for that.
Maybe the fourth thing to add is, yeah, you need to have a risk appetite and be prepared that you're wrong. So for sure.
I would say that's probably a criteria, right, for CEO. Like they've got to understand the balance, risk and reward, but you can't be conservative, because if you're conservative as a CEO, you might as well not be there, right? You can just operate it. The business just operates. There's no decision to be made. Just keep going. Wherever the market takes you, the market takes you. That's not CEOing. You know, what a CEO does is try and get ahead of the market and push it forward. So you need to have that risk appetite. But you also, like, to what degree? I'm just thinking, you know, I must have watched like an old movie or something, Battle of Waterloo or whatnot. And Napoleon, very classically, preferred a general that was lucky rather than good, because he said, "I need a lucky guy." Like, it's so chaotic out there, dynamic battlefield environment. It's total chaos. You gotta have, the lucky guy gets it. So I think the external environment right now in the world looks like it's pretty chaotic. Potentially going to be continuing this like high energy dynamism where no one's like clear what's in control. How do you get lucky in this situation? How do you kind of make sure you're making these bets, but these bets come off? Is there a way in which we could get better at this?
Yeah, I think you have, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, you got to create your own luck, but it is true to some extent. I mean, you need to be trying new things all the time. So you need to have a percentage of time and execution baked into the workforce, into day to day, where you're trying new things and you're making new bets. So because we don't know necessarily what's going to work. I mean, the market can change on a dime. So you need to therefore be trying new things all the time and sort of creating sort of an having, and that gives you an insurance policy to adapt and navigate the changes in the marketplace. So I think that's the only thing you can do to create luck, like focus on the things you can control. And that means constantly making new experimentations, new bets, new hypotheses, while still staying the course.
Yeah, I totally agree on that one. And another thing to make you more lucky is to ride on the mega trends on the market. As long as you ride on the mega trends, a recession will not hit you so hard. So in our case, of course, we're going to bet super hard about automation. That's not going to be so effective about a bad market. And if you go after then the shortage of talents, it's going to be there for 10, 15, 20 years, more and more intense, even though if the market turns around. So if you make sure you bet on the mega trends, that will just naturally help you get lucky, I would say.
Yeah. We have this interesting tension as well as a company of our size, where like you bet on the mega trends and you're trying to build for the future, but realistically you're living day by day as well, so you need to listen closely to the market at the same time. So this weird juggling act where you probably say like 70-80% of your time is still very short-term focused, listening to the customers, solving the challenges right here, right now, but as Victor said, like having your eyes on the bigger, broader challenges that are growing and that will come in the future. It's an interesting challenge as a scale-up that you need to face and deal with every day.
It's a balancing act, but you've already introduced two ideas here. I want to just sit on a little bit, because I think it's important for other entrepreneurs who might be listening to this. Number one, you've got to look is not just a magical thing. It's about like just being exposed to more opportunity than the next guy. And there's things you can do to help you do this. And the two things that we've suggested here is number one, understand where the overall direction of travel is. The mega trends, as Victor mentioned, these are things that are beyond recruiting, right? I would describe a mega trend is outside of our industry. These things are occurring at society level, at a global level, at a longer time frame. So we're talking 50, 100-year time frame. That is the general direction. And I kind of see, I don't know whether you guys swim. I'm a very bad swimmer. I need to be swimming with the tide because I'm not strong enough to swim against it, right? So there's a way in which you could, if you're sitting and you get the right kind of current, you're going to be okay no matter how incompetent you are as a swimmer. That is a good quality to know. And you can pick this. Just educate yourself in the wider market. The second thing to do is to somehow create the space in your busy day to make a bet. So in other words, outside of business as usual, how many of us are optimizing 100% on business as usual? Guess what? There's no space for you to experiment, right? Because you're just like literally doing every single minute is focused on this optimization. You've got to create 20% somehow to say, you know what, this is not business as usual. I'm just going to try and experiment something. Go ahead, Victor.
And just to connect that one to the understanding that you might not be the best CEO, is that I now have the power to bring up so many ideas. You can ask anyone in the organization. They are tired of all my ideas and we can't go after all of them. But I have so much power left in my brain to just start like developing the product and working with from a customer perspective. How could we create as much customer value as possible, and how could we challenge the market? I have the freedom to do that one because I am not sitting on the CEO role or CEO. And the same goes for Richard, the co-founder. He's not the CTO. He could be, but he's not. So me and him is sitting actually in the same room and bouncing ideas every single day and then trying to prioritize it and then bring it into the team.
You know what? That's actually a really interesting formula, because it seems to me that almost you two, the founders of almost like the R&D function for Adway, like the innovation center of the business. So it's very difficult for anybody to innovate if they have operational responsibilities. A lot of people listening to this are recruiters. They have massive operational overhead. They have to do so much work. You know, and we wonder why sometimes, you know, you're throwing together like a legacy process or an old school way of doing it. You don't have time to innovate. The switching cost from the new thing is too much. So you need to carve out the time. And it seems that in your case, you've actually carved out some leadership units that focus on the innovation side, which hopefully will lead to competitive advantage on the product dev and market development as you go on. That's a super interesting way to think about how to be more creative as a company.
Their actual titles is interesting. I mean, you can change titles around, but I mean, Victor is actually head of growth, and Richard is head of innovation, which is kind of product and new opportunities. So it's exactly how we structured it. You're perfectly right on it. You need to create that mind space.
You just rewind back, for instance, into, let's say, recruitment agency era, back in your era, Victor, and in-house guys who are working in in-house department. Like, do we have in that structure a function that does innovation? Answer is obviously no. Everyone is an operational recruiter or operational something. And even the very top, the person who may be responsible for innovation, maybe the top person, they're operating this department. They're operating the business.
And there's a fundamental challenge in the market, as I see it as well, is that the majority of the individuals is coming from an HR background. But in a competitive market, as we are in right now, you need to treat the candidates as potential prospects. And you need to go within a marketing and a sales angle. That's the background in order to get them into the funnel. But once they've been in the funnel and they start like applying, then you could put in the HR experience doing all the assessments and qualification, map it to organization, etc. But now we're forcing recruiters to do a sales and marketing job in many cases, which is tricky, I think.
You know what? That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. It may well be they're two different functions, right? You need to have the post-acquisition of the candidate. Maybe that's where the HR mindset is actually ideal, because it's compliance-driven, it's process-driven, efficiency, all that type of stuff, necessary things to do to process this through. But pre-acquisition, that's where you need to have a different type of person, more recruiter, more of a sales guy or marketing type. I had a very good conversation, very interesting workshop with a bunch of HR leaders actually in Berlin 2 weeks ago. And they were HR, they were more HR than TA or recruiting, right? And some of them did mention that they're aware of it. They mentioned we actually need more urgency in the people that we're recruiting, because we can't have a person sitting there waiting for a sign off or somebody, waiting for someone to just sitting and hoping, just basically adhering purely to process and not sort of pushing the thing through. And that's something maybe recruiters have more of an inherent
capability to do. Yes, sorry to interrupt. But EVP is popular, right? Everywhere now. Now you need to have your EVP in shape. If you're a big organization, you need to map out your personas and archetypes, etc. But even big organizations, I've been reading so many EVPs and definitions of it, is still on a really high level. Like, this is what's going to be attractive for you as an employee, as us as an employer overall, but they don't break it down as you would do in sales, right? You don't do it that specifically for your tech people for the London office and do something else for the sales people in the office in Paris, and you do something else. So we do not spend so much time of defining it. And if we're not spending time of defining it, we're absolutely not spending any time of doing recruitment marketing towards that audience in a sales and marketing perspective.
Let me add a cynical angle to this, Victor, because I agree with you 100%. But I think there's actually a resistance towards defining it. There's almost a preference to keep it abstract because it's like, it's very aspirational when it's that way. You put it out there, you can really craft the story, you can really talk about it in a rhetorical sense. But you know, can you break that down? What does it translate into behaviors and actions? Because that's when I can operate on it and push it forward. For instance, I make the argument it's possible to quantify culture. Like, yes, you can count things that occur and you can basically say something about a culture that has X number of things occur in it. Typically, I get lambasted for this. It's like, you can't quantify culture. It's amorphous. It's nebulous. Yes, I get it's nebulous, but it's probably different if you have a culture that has, on average, 5 meetings per person compared to a culture that has, on average, 20 meetings per person.
Yeah.
You can actually count this. So I think there's a resistance in the recruiting community, HR community, for the definition. I don't know why, but that seems to be my experience.
But my feeling is it's going in the right direction, but the movement is going slow. It's not going in the wrong direction, at least. But in comparison to how a marketing department and a sales department are joint departments nowadays, that's still not the case with marketing and HR or NTA. They're still blocking each other out a bit, and you're not doing it in the level you need to do it.
Yeah, how does that translate into a sales challenge for Adway? How does that sort of translate into a business problem for you guys?
Feel free, Adrian, to jump in.
No, you're in the thick of it. I mean, clearly, it's wouldn't say it's a challenge. I mean, it's just part of what we accept that we need to work with multiple stakeholders. We need to help build business cases and help show the organization the value of sort of coming together and reappropriating money and actually working together towards a common goal. So we do that a lot. I mean, not necessarily all the time. Some organizations are very getting much more well-versed on social recruiting and understand the value of it. So it's easy for them to move faster, maybe because they've tried other solutions, they've tried it themselves. But it's definitely part of what our as we're coming to the UK in particular, where we've had this way of working in the Nordics, where we've really had to help show the value, build business cases, work with them, help them build, fight for new budgets without being without feeling like they're being antagonistic in the organization or taking anything away from everyone. So it becomes sort of an inclusive way of selling. But ultimately, we're in discussions, with marketing departments, people who are sitting on employer branding that aren't in the HR department, working with HR and TA, bringing them together to work towards a common goal. I think that ultimately we'll see the value of the fact that since we offer ultimately a solution that will automate the entire workflow, we're giving them all what they really want to be doing. So then it makes it a little bit easier for them to sort of motivate.
Usually I try to ask sorry for interrupting. I asked the organization, so what's your conversion rate on your career page? And hopefully they have an answer to it. Not in all cases, they don't even know. Mm-hmm. And then they say, maybe 5%, not so good. 10% good, 15% really good. And then my next question is, okay, so what are you doing with the rest of the 90% of your traffic to your career page? And then in some cases, they may say, we do some remarketing or retargeting approach to it, but that's actually very rare. And then if you drill down that one further down, you ask, okay, so how do you then retarget your audience within your tech department? Everyone that has visiting your tech roles the last 6 months, how do you retarget them? And what's your communication towards that audience to convince them to convert into an applicant? And at this level of question, no one could really answer it because they are usually not doing anything. And what this means is that as a recruiting organization, let's say you have 1,000 recruiters doing a really, really hard job on LinkedIn and headhunting and sending messages, bringing a lot of traffic to your career page, but then you're just wasting the rest of the candidates brought into your career page. So you should find some way to empower your traffic that you already have. I have some strange guy screaming at my outside the window.
You know, that's usually my experience because I live in like East London, and there's like craziness happening on my street all the time.
It's the equivalent in Gothenburg where we have our office.
Where you guys are? I totally get it. I used to set up a YouTube channel called Hoxton Street Action because there was like every night there'll be some incident on the street that was worthy of being broadcast. it was crazy. All right. What about GDPR? What about where we're going with ads and privacy generally? Like, isn't ad retargeting dead because, you know what, it's like bad to have to track this person? And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff going on over the last 5 years in particular that seems to be going against the flow of being able to target people. Again, this is not an ethical problem. I have no issue with targeting as it happens, but it seems the overall atmosphere is hostile to it. How do you position against that? Is this not a mega trend that you should dodge? Like, why are you sitting in the middle of it?
Yeah, good question. And I'm getting this question on in every conversation with the customers as well. So we have our own lawyers internally, making sure we are following all the guidelines in all countries, right? First of all. Secondly, you need to think about social media as well. If you want to go after the passive candidates on social media itself do not want to bring the traffic away from social media. So you want to keep your traffic inside Facebook, inside Instagram, inside YouTube, and inside LinkedIn. This is how social media platforms will always work. So they will then promote ads that will stay within the platform. So you need to do all your retargeting and all your behavioral analysis inside the social media posts. So as long as you do it inside the social media platforms, you will never have a problem with tracking and cookie policies because you have already inside the ecosystem. So then you need to just expand your experience within the social media platforms, so to say. But connecting the career page traffic and social media, in that way, you need to then following the cookie consents and allow the traffic to be tracked. Basically. Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. I mean, it's interesting. Go on, Adrian, you're about to say something.
Yeah, I could add something. I mean, having come from spending 15 years in the online advertising industry, it's like there will always be a new solution of some kind. So whether it's not the traditional cookie today and it's going to be a new form of cookie in a particular environment, which Victor was just mentioning, that will happen for sure. But I think one of the biggest problems that we've seen as it relates to cookies is the fact that, one, people ultimately are feeling like they're being spammed. And obviously there's a feeling, of course, that they're being watched and they're getting they're having a bad experience. So even from our perspective, as we try to navigate this, no matter whether it's a cookie or it's a new type of cookie or a new type of way of tracking and reaching people, having the right creativity and having a degree of personalization that doesn't feel spooky, that actually speaks and offers value through the ads and is super important. I think that is actually, that's where the online advertising industry or digital marketing industry went wrong. It decided to just follow, track people with really crappy experiences, and we all got sick of it. So we're in having really hyper-personalized, really rich sort of creative experiences as well. I think you have to balance those things.
It's really interesting because I think there's an incoherent ethical problem with the on the privacy issue because on one side I think we default to the idea that any kind of tracking is inherently bad. But I don't think the case has been made that that's the case. I mean, that we actually like personalization. What would the world look like if we didn't have this? It would go back to the Web 1 era, you know, the Lycos Alta Vista era, where every single online experience was just a blizzard of ads, complete chaos, because there was no tracking. They were just throwing everything at everything. And that was, you know, what we had. So I think we've somehow forgotten about that early era with our, I would say, our enthusiasm I think, well-meaning legislation to try and protect people's privacy. But at the same time, it kind of maybe producing an outcome that isn't what people want either. For instance, the modern web experience is obviously just a complete horror show with needing to consent for cookies, needing to opt out of this, needing to opt into a newsletter, needing to get through a reg wall. It's like you got to click five times before you get any type of content. So I think we've kind of like tried to do the right thing, and now we've morphed it into something, you know, a little bit unpleasant. And I do wonder where we're going to end up, you know, where we're going to end up being overly protective of privacy, so that yes, you can't ever target anybody ever. And it's how does that work? You know,
if you look at just what's happened in the pandemic, I don't know what your inbox looks like, Hung, but I've definitely noticed and I experienced in the last 2 years, there's like so much more spammy email marketing than bad ads online. You know, like I think there's been a shift there, and I actually think that's a bigger problem right now than the online advertising experience, I would say. So maybe, as you say, like, where's the world going? I don't know. It just moves to another place.
Here's the thing. I don't see the difference between me doing a bit of research on a particular prospect, remembering your name, and then writing an email by using your name. That is effectively tracking, isn't it? You know, why is that bad? That's not bad. That's considered good sales, sales even.
Yeah, so, but there's always a line in the sand, right? And the line is different for different individuals. Like if someone would track my iPhone and what I'm talking with this podcast, and then I get to see the ads, that's, for me, it's quite spooky. Now, not the case right now, but where's the line of getting really relevant ads, but they are tracking too much of my private life, and where it's actually beneficial for me to get the retargeted ad. As an individual, let's say you're not in a modus of looking for a new job, right? Which is the industry we work in, and you then will get displayed with on a Monday afternoon after having a really tough Monday morning, and you have arguments with your manager, you're sitting on the subway, and suddenly you will see a really appealing ad for an employer you never thought of before. Of course, it's gonna prompt your interest, and you go in, and in some cases you will apply. Is that good or is it bad?
Well, I think clearly good, but you raise a very interesting point. Like, how can you actually do the predictive stuff without actually understanding the behavior of the person? And understanding the behavior of the person does require you to track them without their consent. Because if their person, you've already said, oh, can I consent to you doing this? You've already altered the behavior by asking that person. You know, their behaviors will be different as a result of the question. It's participant observation. You can't do it. You have to observe it without the consent. But then, of course, we run into this, you know, privacy dilemma. So I think it's a very interesting wrestling challenge. I think you're right, Adrian, though, there'll always be a way to do it. I think we do need new ways to discover services, products, jobs. You know, we can't just rely on every individual to have absolutely everything together so that they can do their own discovery. That's actually a lot of work. You need to service them with stuff that they're interested in, and hopefully we'll get to a point where, you know, we can sensibly strike some sort of balance there. Okay, folks, we're coming to the end of the show, so I wanted to just ask two more questions, really. Actually, three more questions. Number one, what exciting things is going to be happening for Adway customers in 2022? You got 6 months left in the year. Is there any interesting product stuff, any interesting news you can tell us that's happening for existing customers for the product?
Yeah. I was going to write down the three questions. You go, Adrian.
No, I mean, we have we've been developing new products for the last year, and like testing them out. So we're seeing a whole lot of new features, new functionalities within the platform, new products coming that will solve a few more problems than what we're doing just today. So we've been we've been doing a lot of things in and around landing pages and application products and lead forms and all sorts of things like that. So those things are coming. In fact, some of them are here already. But we're going to continue to develop that. We're getting our analytics is getting richer as well. So there's going to be more insights. So we're going to make our customers even smarter and fuel them with the right information. And you know, we continue to invest in the platform, in the core platform. At the same time, we, you know, the smarter it can become, the more AI we can use, the more intelligent our social talent pools become. Of course, the customers are going to feel the benefits of that. So we're making a lot of investments in the tech platform, and we have been for the last 12 months. We're starting to see that all come to fruition now. So a lot of exciting things we'll be announcing throughout the year. But it's a constant development cycle for us.
A lovely summer of everything there. But if I could underline a big problem on the market, when we bring in traffic to the career pages, you still have some ATS legacy systems that are not so conversion optimized, you could say.
Yeah,
I guess you've experienced this one before or seen this, right?
100%. You fill in the form before you can access the information. We get it. Yeah.
So it's the same with e-commerce. Like if you demand so many steps in an e-commerce store, you will never get to sell anything. So we actually have a product that is ATS agnostic now that could capture all the information and push it through the APIs.
Nice.
So you can skip the entire registration step if you need. So that's a really cool product.
That's really useful because you can't be waiting for these big legacy ATSs to update the way in which they do things. They have such a strong sort of presence in these big companies, and oftentimes their product development is super slow. Maybe they not even have the incentive to change it, you know. So that's a smart thing if you can help.
Yeah, and they have beautiful APIs, right? So they actually want the customers to do it themselves. But then you need to go to a marketing company or a web developing company and do it. Mm-hmm. So in our case, it's a plug and play solution. You plug it in and then you will increase your conversion rate by maybe 200-300% on your career page. And that's it.
There you go. Like someone needs to use that as a strap line, a bit of reusable marketing right there. Okay. Listen, folks, we're coming to the end of it. The two more questions are, number one, if you could give one piece of advice to a founder or a person that is thinking about doing entrepreneurship, maybe they're a recruiter right now, maybe they're an HR person, but they're thinking, you know what, I want to do my own thing. What one piece of advice would you give them from your own experience on the journeys that you've had? Adrian, you go first.
Choose something that you'll be passionate about. Really simple. I mean, it's going to be a 10-year journey. You've got to love it. You've got to want to get up out of bed every day and do it. It's a hard slog being an entrepreneur. So choose something that you love. And do it with people that you love as well. Don't do it on your own.
Yeah, so really, really good advice. I think number one, the reason why passion is an important thing is it gives you longevity and it gives you resilience against the inevitable bumps in the road. Okay, Victor, your one bit of advice?
Yeah, so I love the other advice, but if I were to pick something else then, I would say find a champion customer you can work really close with in the beginning of your product development. And make sure you build up a really nice MVP and define your product, and then you could bother about scaling. So many bother about scaling first without actually having a product that the market wants.
Absolutely right. Like, don't think about attacking a market. If there's one customer that really is into what you're doing, double, triple down on working with that, and then actually something will emerge from it that would look really exciting. Maybe the lower risk, higher reward option to do. Okay, that's about it, folks. Final question, what are you doing after this show? So obviously you're going to scramble down some lunch, Adrian, but what are the work stuff have you got to do today?
I mean, I'm just like, it's meetings back to back. I'm actually getting kicked out of the room as we speak.
Right.
So
he's got to go. Yeah. Off you go. See you later, Adrian. How about you, Victor? What are you doing today?
I'm going to have a nice conversation about our big new office we're going to sign. So I'm going to look at concept sketches and in the new office. It's going to be amazing.
All right, cool. Guys, it's been a wonderful conversation with you two. Thank you so much for coming on to Founders Focus. I'm sure the crowd has enjoyed it. I'll be looking forward to seeing how you two get on with this business. So good luck to Adway and good luck to everyone who's working in there. Thanks for coming on the show, folks.
Thank you. I love to hang for having us. Thank you.
It was great.
Weren't they great, guys? It's so interesting. Always very interesting speaking to people who are just on this entrepreneurial journey. So and building very interesting recruiting products as well. So anyway, folks, thanks for watching. We'll be back on BrainFuel Live. We're back on Friday. We're going to be talking about how to organize a sourcing jam. So if you're looking to rapidly fill your pipeline, what better way of doing that than actually getting your sort of department to help you do it? How do you organize, let's say, your tech department to help you do some sourcing? That's what we're going to be talking about on Friday. So make sure you register on that. You can follow the channel on this, actually, and you'll be updated on the stuff that's there. So we'll see you on Friday. Thanks for watching so far.